Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Three acquaintances of mine have taken leave of sanity and become hopelessly, insanely infatuated with their new portable telecommunications gizmos. Two iPhones and an iPad. I've suffered through demonstrations of the gadgets from all three owners. Now, with its tiny virtual keyboard, the iPhone does not make a good typewriter. With its very small screen, it does not make a good web browser. One owner told me that it actually does not work all that well as a telephone. Then I was amused at the revelation that these gizmos keep a secret, permanent, unencrypted log of your location through time. Hey, pal, if it's making that log, somebody's going to be accessing it. And it's not you. You aren't even told about it. How much money did you pay for that thing? And how often do you feel the need to read your email or check the sports scores while in the pasta aisle of the supermarket? Later I discovered this wonderful lecture that Professor Neil Postman delivered in 1998. Postman was a media theorist, education theorist, and cultural critic. He died in 2003. This lecture was even broadcast on C-SPAN, and it's a fine one. It's about technology and society, about how to act wisely in an age of rapidly advancing technology. Postman proposes six questions about any new technology, questions people should consider before blindly adopting whatever technology comes down the pike next. He'll discuss the first four of these questions today. Here's Dr. Neil Postman speaking of new technology back in January 1998.
Now, we can expect that the cloning of human beings will be a reality. Now, I think we can say that we have here a genuine 21st century problem. It would be interesting, wouldn't it, to speculate on what Jesus or the Buddha would say about this development in human reproduction. Well, we'll have to address this matter without them. Now, how will we do that? Who has an answer we'll find acceptable? Now, here is one I imagine most of you will find unacceptable. Cloning human beings opens up a whole new field of human spare parts. The way it would work is that every time someone is born, a clone of this person would be made. The clone would be kept in a special, confined and well-guarded place so that it could provide spare parts for the original person as needed throughout life. If the original person loses a kidney or lung at some time in his or her life, we would simply take it from the clone. Now, I know you will protest that the clone is, after all, a real human being. But that would only be the case if we define the clone as a human being. There's nothing new in human beings defining other human beings as non-human things. In all cases of genocide, that is exactly the procedure. Aldous Huxley wrote about how to do such things, although he did so ironically and bitterly. In our own times, Marvin Minsky and others working in the field of artificial intelligence have prophesied quite enthusiastically that humans will become merely pets of their computers, so that the definition of the worth and capacity of humans will change. Now, I hope you are thinking that my proposal is simply a bad joke, and that any such proposal seriously made is a product of a depraved mind. Well, of course, I agree with you. But it is difficult not to be depraved in the era in which we live. Here, for example, are a few sentences from a very popular book called Being Digital by Nicholas Negroponte, who is, not surprisingly, a professor at MIT. He says, and I quote, "In the next millennium, we will find we are talking as much or more with machines than we are with humans. What seems to trouble people most, he says, is their self-consciousness about talking to inanimate objects. Now, Negroponte envisions a time when we may speak to a doorknob or a toaster, and he predicts that when we do, we will find the experience no more uncomfortable than talking to a telephone answering machine. He has nothing to say about how we may become different by talking to doorknobs, as we already have become different by talking to telephone answering machines. Negroponte is concerned only that we adapt to our technological future. He nowhere addresses the psychic or social meaning of adaptation. People are quite capable of adapting to all sorts of things. Soldiers adapt themselves to killing. Children adapt themselves to being fatherless. Women can adapt themselves to being abused. I have no doubt that we can adapt ourselves to talking much more to machines than to people. We may even come to prefer it. But adaptation ought not to be equated with sanity. It is possible to have a nation of adapters who are quite insane. Anyone who has lived in this century can hardly deny that. Now, it's not my intention this afternoon to give a Cassandra-like presentation. I know you'll be pleased to know this. In fact, quite the opposite. My talk wishes to address the question of how to remain sane in a furious, speeded-up technological society. And the way I hope to do it is to provide you with six questions, the answers to which can provide insights into the way technology intrudes itself into a culture. As I see them, the questions can be applied at two different levels and in two different ways. One can ask them about one's own life in relation to technology, and one can also ask them in relation to the general society. That is to say, the questions can have a political dimension. Now, when I'm done, if we have time, I would be happy to tell you, if you wish, how I have applied these questions to my own life. And you might be interested to know, since, as you can tell, I'm an eminently sane person. Now to my questions. Question one needs to be addressed when anyone tells us about a new technology. For example, interactive television, virtual reality, high definition TV, the information superhighway, or whatever. The question is this: what is the problem to which this technology is a solution? Now, this question needs to be asked because there are technologies that are not solutions to any problem that a normal person would regard as significant. Although Vice President Al Gore is certainly a normal person, I am skeptical of the reasons even he gives for us spending billions of dollars to create an information superhighway. He says repeatedly that the highway will provide each of us with access to 500 or perhaps even 1,000 television stations. I am therefore obliged to ask, is this a problem most of us yearn to have solved? Indeed, need to have solved. Do we believe that having access to 40 or 50 stations, as we now do, is inadequate, and that we cannot achieve a fulfilled life unless we have 1,000 stations to choose from? What exactly is the problem to be solved here? Well, whatever it is, we are entitled to ask about it and even to be skeptical about it. A good example, by the way, of when such skepticism was helpfully applied concerns a question raised some years ago, a political question, as it turned out, as to whether or not the United States government should subsidize the manufacture of a supersonic jet. Both the British and French had already built SSTs, and a serious debate ensued in the halls of Congress and elsewhere as to whether or not we should have one of our own. And so the question was asked, what is the problem to which the supersonic jet is the solution? The answer, it turns out, was that it takes 6 hours to go from New York to L.A. in a 747. In a supersonic jet, it can be done in 3. Now, most Americans, I'm happy to say, did not think that that was a sufficiently serious problem to warrant such a heavy investment. Besides, some Americans asked, what would we do with the 3 hours we saved? And their answer was, we'd probably watch television. And so the suggestion was made that we put television sets on the 747s and thereby save billions of dollars. Now, in addition to this, another question was asked. Well, before I get to that, I should mention that 2 years ago, I went to buy a car, a Honda Accord, and which I'd been told was a pretty good car. And when I went to get it, the salesman told me that it had cruise control, for which there's an extra charge. And so I asked him, what is the problem to which cruise control is the solution? And he said, well, no one had ever asked him that question before. But then he said, it's the problem of keeping your foot on the gas. So I said, well, I'd been driving for 35 years, and I never really found that to be a problem. He said the car had electric windows, so you know what I asked him. And he was ready for me this time. He said, it's the problem of having to do this, or worse, this. I told him that that I didn't really think this was a problem, and besides, I'm an academic and I live a rather sedate life, and a little exercise here and there. But I bought the Honda Accord with cruise control, with electric windows, because you cannot get that car without those things, which is worth just keeping in mind, because many people will say new technologies always increase our options. And, of course, very often they do. But they just as frequently decrease our options, and we have to keep that in mind when we think about new technologies. Now, here's another question that I think we need to ask as a follow-up to the first one. After one has answered the question, what is the problem to which a particular technology is the solution, I think one must ask, whose problem is it? Now, in the case of the SST, the problem of getting to L.A. or London faster than 747s could do it was largely a problem for movie stars, rock musicians, and corporate executives. Hardly a problem that most Americans would regard as worth solving if it would cost them a lot of money. But this question, whose problem is it, needs to be applied to any technology. Most technologies do solve some problem, but the problem may not be everybody's problem or even most people's problem. We need to be very careful in determining who will benefit from a technology and who will pay for it. They are not always the same people. But let's say we have found a technological solution to a problem most people do have. We now come to a third question. It's this. Suppose we solve this problem and solve it decisively. What new problems might be created because we have solved the problem? Now, the automobile solved some very important problems for most people, but in doing so has poisoned our air, has choked our cities with traffic, and has contributed towards the destruction of some of the beauty of our natural landscape. Antibiotics have certainly solved some significant problems for almost all people, but in doing so have resulted in the weakening of what we call our immune systems. Television has solved several important problems, but in solving them has changed the nature of political discourse, has led to a serious decline in literacy, and has even made the traditional process of socializing children difficult, if not impossible. Now, it's doubtful that you could think of any single technology that did not generate new problems as a result of its having solved an old problem. Of course, it's sometimes very difficult to know what new problems will arise as a result of a technological solution. Benedictine monks invented the mechanical clock in the 13th century in order to be more precise in performing their canonical prayers, which they needed to do 7 times a day. Had they known that the mechanical clock would eventually be used by merchants as a means of establishing a standardized workday and then a standardized product, that is, that the clock would be used as an instrument for making money instead of serving God, the monks might have decided that their sundials were quite sufficient. Had Gutenberg foreseen that his printing press with movable type would lead to the breakup of the Holy Roman See, he surely would have used his old wine press to make wine and not books. In the 13th century, perhaps it didn't matter so much if people lacked a technological vision, perhaps not even in the 15th century. But in a technological society such as ours, we can no longer afford to move into the future with our eyes tightly closed. We need to speculate in an open-eyed way about negative possibilities. But as I've said, it's no easy matter to know what sorts of problems a new technology will generate. To produce interesting and responsible answers requires knowledge of the history of technology and of technology's social effects and of the principles governing technological change, all of which I'm sorry to say most Americans know little about. In fact, the average college-educated American cannot tell you, given a 1,000-year margin of error, when the phonetic alphabet was invented, or given a 500-year margin of error, when the printing press with movable type was invented, let alone say anything intelligible about the social and psychic effects of these inventions. Well, we'll probably need to do something about that in the years ahead. But it's not sufficient to reflect in a general way on the possible costs of technology. In order to give some focus to our reflections, we have to pose a fourth question. It's this: which people and what institutions might be most seriously harmed by a technological solution? Now, this was the question, by the way, that gave rise to the Luddite movement in England during the years 1811 to 1818. The people we call Luddites were skilled manual workers in the garment industry at the time when mechanization was taking command and the factory system was being put into place. They knew perfectly well what advantages mechanism would bring to most people, but they also saw with equal clarity how it would bring ruin to their own ways of life, especially to their children, who were being employed as virtual slave laborers in factories. They resisted technological change by the simplistic and in the end useless expedient of smashing to bits industrial machinery, which they continued to do until they were imprisoned or killed by the British Army. Now, no one knows where the word Luddite came from, but the word has come to mean a person who resists technological change in any way, and it's usually used as an insult. Now, why this is so is a bit puzzling to me, since only a fool doesn't know that new technologies always produce winners and losers, and there is nothing irrational about loser resistance. Bill Gates, who is, of course, a winner, knows this, and because he is no fool, his propaganda continuously implies that computer technology can bring harm to no one. Well, that's the way of winners. They want losers to be grateful and enthusiastic, and especially, best of all, to be unaware that they are losers. Let's take school teachers as an example of losers who are deluded into thinking they are winners. Now, I think you'll agree with me if I say that we need more teachers and that we ought to pay more to those we have. I think you could hardly disagree that school boards are resistant to hiring more teachers and to paying them more, and that they complain continuously about a shortage of funds. Now, this resistance and those complaints notwithstanding, the fact is that school boards are now preparing to spend in the aggregate billions of dollars to wire schools in order to accommodate computer technology, and for reasons that are by no means clear. There certainly does not exist any compelling evidence that PCs or the internet or any other manifestation of computer technology can do for children what good, well-paid, underburdened teachers can do. So, where is the outcry from teachers? They are losers in this deal, and they are serious losers. Here, for example, is an announcement of an insult to teachers, which I could have used many others, but this one is from June 1996 edition of the Washington Post. I'm quoting: "The state of Maryland plans to connect every public school to the internet this year, part of a $53 million effort to give students greater access to far-flung information via computer, Governor Paris and Clendenning announced yesterday. I'm still quoting. Despite mixed reviews by national analysts who have studied computer use in schools, the plan calls for each of Maryland's 1,262 public schools to have at least two computer terminals linked to the internet before winter, and for every classroom to have 3 to 5 such terminals within 5 years, unquote. Governor Clendenning, by the way, calls this a bold and big initiative and expects tens of millions of additional dollars to be donated by private enterprise so that the total expenditure will be close for this 1 year to be close to $100 million. Here is his justification, and again, I quote, accessing information is the first vital step in understanding and ultimately improving the world we live in, unquote. Now let's put aside the fact that at best this is a problematic claim and at worst nonsense. Let's also put aside the fact that even if the governor's claim is true, American students already have an oversupply of sources of information and do not require a multi-million dollar investment to be well-informed citizens. Putting all that aside, will you agree with me that the following hypothetical statement, which I'm making up, would be happier news and more rational for both teachers and students? Quote, I'm quoting my own statement. The state of Maryland intends to spend $100 million to increase the number of teachers in the state, to pay those we have more, and to reduce teaching loads. Governor Clendenning said, this is a vital step toward assuring that our students will be given a more attentive, wholesome, and creative education, unquote. Now, I should think most teachers would support such an investment, but we hear very little from them on this score. In fact, many teachers are thrilled, absolutely thrilled, by the thought of a $100 million investment in computer terminals. Bill Gates loves this sort of stupidity.
The late Professor Neil Postman, speaking in 1998, on 4 questions we should ask before adopting any new technology. What is the problem this will solve? Whose problem is it? What new problems will this solution create? And who will be harmed when the technology is implemented? Strikingly, from a 2011 perspective, he never mentions nuclear power. Next week, 2 more questions, plus some other stuff. Thanks for listening. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.